If you had the smartest Wi-Fi, it'd be Xfinity. It would boost speeds to the devices that needed them most and protect you from threats at home and online. Xfinity. Imagine that. Restrictions apply.
Morning, I'm Dave Freeman. It's 8 o'clock.
Good morning. The Supreme Court hears arguments today in President Trump's attempt to fire regulators he disagrees with. What is the unitary executive theory Trump wants to become law? It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
On KQED News, West Contra Costa Unified teachers are still on strike. I'm Brian Watt.
Trump skipped the Kennedy Center honors in his first term. This time, he hosted. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Trump made himself chair of the board earlier this year and was heavily involved in picking last night's honorees. And a former chief usher of the White House shares what it's like to be a nonpartisan federal worker in one of the most partisan workplaces in the country. It's Monday, December 8th. On this day in 1941, the U.S. declared war against Japan and entered World War II, the day after Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. European leaders are rallying around Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in London today. That's as Russia and the Trump administration ramp up pressure on Ukraine. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports French President Emmanuel Macron has accused Russia of failing to look for peace.
Macron said Ukraine can count on Europe's unwavering support as he joins the British Prime Minister, German Chancellor, and other European leaders in London. Macron condemned Russia's continued attacks on Ukrainian cities and energy infrastructure during the peace talks. Speaking about the amended peace plan draft, President Trump suggested Zelensky could be the sticking point. Trump said the Ukrainian president didn't appear ready to sign the deal and that, quote, his people love it and I'm pretty sure Russia is fine with it. Polls show a large majority of Ukrainians are not fine with peace at any cost and don't want to give away Ukrainian cities to Russia as the Kremlin demands. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Kyiv.
The developer of an app known as IceBlock has sued the Trump administration. NPR's Bobby Allen reports the suit comes after Apple banned the IceBlock app under pressure from the White House.
IceBlock is an app that went viral for allowing users to anonymously send out alerts when Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents were conducting a raid. Joshua Aaron is the app's developer.
It would alert users within a 5-mile radius of that location, and they would get a notification on their phone, and then they could make a decision on whether or not they wanted to be in that vicinity.
Attorney General Pam Bondi said the app endangers federal agents. Bondi has said Aaron is under investigation, and she convinced Apple to remove the app from its app store. Now Aaron is suing the Trump administration for violating his First Amendment rights and making unlawful threats against him for protected speech. The Justice Department and Apple did not immediately respond to requests for comment. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
Media company Paramount has launched a hostile takeover bid for media company Warner Brothers Discovery. Just last week, online streamer Netflix announced it would try to buy Warner Brothers for $72 billion. Now, Paramount says it will beat that with a $74 billion offer. Thailand has been launching airstrikes against Cambodia today. Reporter Michael Sullivan says the strikes are along their disputed border.
Both sides are blaming the other for starting the latest clashes, with Thailand's Prime Minister Anutin Chanvirakul stating that the time for negotiation is over for now, with Thai media quoting the Army Chief of Staff saying Thailand's objective is to render the Cambodian military ineffective for a long time. Cambodia's former strongman, Hun Sen, accused Thailand of trying to provoke a reaction and urged Cambodia's forces to exercise patience.
Michael Sullivan reporting. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 230 points. This is NPR.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. Good morning. Closing arguments are set to begin today in the San Francisco murder trial of filmmaker and journalist Kevin Epps. KQED's Juan Carlos Lara reports.
Epps is known for his documentary Straight Outta Hunters Point. He's charged with murder in the death of Marcus Polk, his sister-in-law's ex-husband. Though both sides acknowledge that Epps fatally shot Polk, the trial has centered on whether the killing was justified self-defense. The legal team for Epps conceded that he was guilty of possessing a firearm as a convicted felon, so even if he's found not guilty of murder, they say he will still be sentenced for that possession. Regardless of the outcome, closing arguments mean Epps is one step closer to the end of the legal battle that began when he was charged in 2019. I'm Juan Carlos Lara, KQED News.
An autonomous vehicle expert is calling incidents of Waymo cars passing stop school buses a troubling pattern for the Bay Area-based company. Waymo says it's issuing a voluntary software recall related to the incidents. Carnegie Mellon Emeritus Professor Philip Koopman has studied self-driving cars for three decades. He says it's alarming that Waymo allowed its cars to allegedly pass stop school buses in Austin, Texas, 19 times.
Why did the school district have to complain and resort to what amounts to public shaming before Waymo would fix it?
Waymo has said it moved quickly to address the issue and that no injuries occurred related to the recall. Sports. The Warriors beat the Bulls 123-91. The Sharks beat the Hurricanes 4-1. I'm Brian Watt, KQED News.
Support today comes from San Francisco Bay University, offering degree programs in tech and business for a world shaped by AI. sfbu.edu. Support for NPR comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, telling stories behind data and trends that shape our world today through its podcast, After the Fact. Learn more at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact. And the listeners and supporters of KQED. Back to our traffic desk with Mel Baker with the latest on the BART commute.
So electrical problems have caused problems between the Powell and Embarcadero stations, and it's causing a major system-wide delay. Crews are on the scene working on repairs. Since our last update, BART has decided that it will, in fact, shut down the red and green lines to reduce delays through the system. Only the yellow line is running through the Transbay Tube right now. Blue line service in the East Bay is continuing, so you should plan on being prepared to transfer to get to your destination. All 50 stations are open. You can get anywhere in the system, but trains will likely be crowded and delayed. Mel Baker for KQED.
Transit support this morning comes from Murphy McKenna Construction, Custom Home Builders. Coming right up, KQED News with Brian Watt reporting from Oakland at 822. One of California's biggest draws is the large number of national parks. Now employees for the parks are bracing for another change from the Trump administration. This time, how DEI comes up at gift shops. What does that mean in practice? The story and more at 822 on KQED News. Morning clouds, sunny later today, still areas of dense fog this morning. Bay Area highs, low 50s to the mid-60s inland.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. The Supreme Court will hear oral arguments today in a case that could vastly expand the president's power and erode the power of some regulatory agencies.
The conservative majority on the court has already signaled a willingness to let that happen.
NPR's Andrea Hsu is here to explain. So big day in court, Andrea. Tell us what this case is all about.
Yeah, well, this case started with the firing of Rebecca Slaughter. She was a Democratic commissioner on the Federal Trade Commission. That's the independent agency tasked with protecting consumers from unfair competition. And back in March, she got an email from the White House informing her that she was being removed from office, not because of any wrongdoing, but because her continued service was inconsistent with President Trump's priorities. She sued, saying the president can't fire her because federal law clearly states that FTC commissioners can only be removed for inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance in office.
Okay, and the president didn't accuse Slaughter of any of these things.
No, and the lower court agreed that she couldn't be fired. The judge cited a 1935 Supreme Court decision called Humphrey's Executor. In A, that case involved an FTC commissioner who was fired by FDR over policy disagreements. So the court ruled unanimously that the president has no constitutional power to remove the commissioner for reasons other than those allowed by law. The reason they said was because the FTC's duties are not purely executive in nature, but actually predominantly judicial and legislative.
I did some quick math, Andrea. That was 90 years ago, that case, that 1935 case. So why is it being debated all over again now?
Well, in short, because the Trump administration thinks the Supreme Court got it wrong back in 1935, they argue that the FTC wasn't just doing judicial and legislative work, that it did exercise executive power back then, and far more so today. And they say the Constitution spells out clearly that the president holds all the executive power. Yes, he relies on officers who assist him, including at independent agencies like the FTC, but he must be able to remove those among them who stand in his way. Otherwise, how could he be accountable to the people who elected him? I spoke with James Burnham about this earlier this fall. He's an attorney who's served in both Trump administrations.
I think the removal protections have been unconstitutional from the beginning. I don't think there is such a thing as an independent agency.
So tell us then about the argument that the fired FTC commissioner will bring to court.
Well, Slaughter takes issue with the administration's reading of the Constitution. Here's what she told me last week.
The Constitution does not say the president must do whatever he wants when he's in office. It says he must take care that the laws passed by Congress be faithfully executed.
Including, she says, laws that say the president can only remove officers for cause. She says all the presidents since FDR have agreed with this setup until now. Now, on Friday, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals upheld the firings of two other independent agency members, the Merit Systems Protection Board and the National Labor Relations Board. The court found that because those agencies wield significant executive powers, the 1935 precedent doesn't apply.
All right. So what else should we be listening for?
Well, there will probably be talk about another independent agency, the Federal Reserve. You know, many people have warned that if the Supreme Court says the president can fire FTC commissioners for any reason, then he can also fire members of the Fed, which would send the economy into chaos. Now, conservative justices on the Supreme Court have called the Fed a uniquely structured quasi-private entity with a distinct history, suggesting they might create a special carve-out. There's actually a whole separate case on this, which the court will hear later this month.
That's NPR's Andrea Hsu. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Okay, let's focus now on what the legal ramifications of the Slaughter case could be. We'll do that with Jeffrey Rosen. He's president and CEO of the National Constitution Center, a nonpartisan group that studies the U.S. Constitution. Good morning, and thank you for being on the program.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So what legal arguments is the Trump administration making to advance its expansive view of presidential powers?
The Trump administration is embracing a version of the so-called unitary executive theory that many conservatives have made since the Reagan administration in the 1980s when Chief Justice Roberts and other justices embraced it. But it really goes back to a debate about the meaning of the time of the founding. And proponents of this theory say that the founders in 1789 decided to create the Treasury and the State Department and the entire administrative state and make it independent of the Congress's ability to constrain the president's power to fire. Basically, the president has to be able to fire any official he appoints. There's a competing view, and it goes back to the great Justice Louis Brandeis, who in a case called Myers versus United States involving presidential power, said the doctrine of the separation of powers was adopted by the convention of 1787 not to promote efficiency, but to preclude the exercise of arbitrary power. The purpose was not to avoid friction, but by means of the inevitable friction incident to the distribution of government powers to save the people from autocracy. That was what Louis Brandeis said.
I mean, what's at stake here in this case if the Trump administration prevails? I mean, how important is this case when cut as a constitutional case?
It's extraordinarily important. It goes back to the foundations of the separation of powers. And if the Trump administration prevails, not only will the president be able to fire any official he appoints, which means that all independent agencies, the Federal Reserve, the Federal Communication Commission, the Federal Trade Commission, the National Labor Relations Board, all will be unconstitutional, and the president will be able to fire people for political reasons. But in addition, all federal civil service protections will be called into question. Right now, the president is limited by law from firing civil servants. They're called inferior officers. But the logic of this decision would allow him to fire people just because he doesn't like them. And then the question is what the remedy will be. And in this case may say that if the president just pays money, he's not required to reinstate them. So basically the two huge stakes in this case are first the constitutionality of independent agencies and second the ability of Congress to insulate civil servants from being fired for purely political reasons.
Would there be any constraints on the powers of the president?
Well, of course, there are political constraints at the ballot box, but if the Supreme Court embraces a very sweeping vision of the unitary executive theory, it would be impossible for Congress to impose any legal constraints on his powers. That's why the question of whether the Federal Reserve might be an exception, which you just discussed, mm-hmm. is important. It's an interesting argument that the precedent for saying the Fed is different is the First Bank of the United States, which was independent of the president, but that was a private corporation. It wasn't a government agency, so therefore invoking that as a precedent for the Federal Reserve is a sort of questionable logical distinction. Essentially, it's impossible logically to distinguish the Fed from other independent agencies, and that's why going back to the history is so important, and it'll be really interesting to see what the originalist justices do with briefs filed in this case suggesting that James Madison himself in 1789 supported the creation of an independent controller of the Treasury who couldn't be fired for no reason, and that Hamilton in Federalist 77 defended limitations on the president's removal authority. This is Alexander Hamilton, who Thomas Jefferson said wanted to resurrect Caesarism in America. At a famous dinner party, Hamilton blurted out, "The greatest man that ever lived was Julius Caesar," and Jefferson accused him of monarchism. But even Alexander Hamilton, according to the briefs, thought the president's removal power could be limited. So it's a fascinating case, it's important, and it just poses two starkly different visions of executive power, the unitary executive versus the constrained executive.
Jeffrey Rosen is the president and CEO of the National Constitution Center and author of the new book, The Pursuit of Liberty, How Hamilton versus Jefferson Ignited the Lasting Battle Over Power in America. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Families in Bethlehem in the occupied West Bank gathered to watch the lighting of the Christmas tree on Saturday for the first time since the war in Gaza began 2 years ago. As NPR's Adil Alshalchi reports, there's hope the economy can turn around after war-related hardships.
The tree glittered in the middle of Manger Square near the site where Christians believe Jesus was born. Fathers held bundled up kids on their shoulders and blue laser beams shot into the sky. People sang and cheered as celebrations returned to Bethlehem for the first time since the war in Gaza began. Wearing a sash of the Palestinian flag, Mayor Maher Qanatawi addressed the crowd.
Despite years of pandemic, war, and hardship, we light this tree to declare that light is stronger than darkness. Bethlehem remains open.
The hardships have taken a toll on tourism in the city, which the local government says made up 80% of its economy. It said unemployment has risen from 14% to 65% in 2 years. Qanatawi said the pain over the war in Gaza, which has killed over 70,000 Palestinians according to health officials, was also not forgotten.
Our people continue to suffer behind walls, under occupation, in exile, and displacement. And in Gaza, where children are born beneath rubble, yet the voice of the angel still whispers, "Do not be afraid."
While a ceasefire brought some hope last October, Israeli attacks continue. Health officials said over 370 Palestinians in Gaza have been killed since the deal. Israeli forces have also ramped up their operations in the West Bank and severely restricted movement, keeping visitors away. But Qanatawi says he hopes for a turning point this season.
Bethlehem stands today with a heart that beats despite pain and with a spirit renewed by the promise of Christmas.
The mayor said he received a message from Pope Leo with a reminder not to surrender to despair and to keep faith strong. Hadil Alshalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
This is NPR News.
And you're listening to Morning Edition on KQED News at 8:19. And Brian Watt with KQED News from Oakland ahead at 8:22. Back to Mel Baker with an update on traffic and transit now.
Yeah, we're going to look at the San Mateo Bridge, 92 eastbound, just after the high rise. The two left lanes are blocked by a vehicle that overturned and landed back on its wheels. But in the westbound direction, people have slowed to watch to look at that crash. It is backed up all the way through the toll plaza, about to the interpretive center. On BART, expect major delays due to a power issue in downtown San Francisco. Be prepared also to transfer. Mel Baker, 4KQED.
Transit traffic support comes to us today from Shen Yun Performing Arts. Support for KQED comes from Silicon Valley Community Foundation, providing funds to support local nonprofits working on the front lines to deliver critical services to those in need, like access to food, health care, and shelter. Learn more at svcf.org. Postman, used by over 40 million developers, Postman offers a platform where teams build APIs to help AI agents and humans make smarter decisions from design to delivery. More information at postman.com. The announcers and technical staff of KQED Radio are affiliated with the National Association of Broadcast Employees and Technicians, CWA Local 51, AFL-CIO.
I'm Alexis Madrigal. Next time on Forum, when was the last time you left the house without your headphones? These days, silence can feel stranger than noise. On the bus, in the grocery store line, even just walking down the street, more of us are living inside private audio bubbles. What does constant listening do to our attention, our relationships, and the social fabric we all share? That's at 9 a.m. right here on KQED.
On the Political Breakdown newsletter this week, Guy Marzorati looks at how Democrats are working to make health care a defining issue in next year's midterms, all the way down to the candidates they recruit. That's in the Political Breakdown newsletter. Support for NPR comes from Heifer International, where people can donate animal gifts like goats, chickens, or sheep to struggling families to help them create sustainable futures. Learn more at heifer.org/NPR. Subaru, the Subaru Share the Love event runs through January 2nd. By year's end, Subaru and its retailers will have donated more than $350 million to charity. Subaru, more than a car company. And Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And the listeners of KQED.
It's Morning Edition on KQED. I'm Brian Watt. California is home to the most national parks in the country. So the latest expansion of a directive by the Trump administration is expected to take a major toll. The Department of the Interior has now mandated that parks, bookstores, and all other retail be reviewed for, quote, equity-related content. That's according to a memo put out last week saying park leaders have until December 19th to review their gift shops. Here to explain is KQED's outdoors reporter, Sarah Wright. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Sure. So if I remember, this isn't the first time parks have had to review their materials this year, right?
Yeah, that's right. Over the summer, the Interior Department had also issued a very similar mandate, and it required park staff to review all their signage and their bookstore materials for anything that could cast Americans, quote, past or living, in a negative light. So this new thing here is essentially an expansion of that order, telling parks that they also now have to root out anything that's, quote, equity related that's sold at parks. And they only have 2 weeks to do it.
Okay, and what does equity related mean in this context?
So the internal memo, which I reviewed, says that parks leaders should be looking for anything that highlights diversity, equity, inclusion, and notably, they added accessibility and environmental justice to that list. So I reached out to the Interior Department with questions about how this will be implemented, but they only sent me a short statement, and it didn't have any specifics beyond what's in the memo. Parks advocates like Jesse Chakarin, who I spoke to, said it's kind of impossible to know what exactly they want removed, but He's worried about losing stories like those of the Buffalo Soldiers, who were black soldiers that patrolled the Sierra Nevada in parks like Yosemite and Sequoia and Kings Canyon. And they were some of the country's first national park rangers.
It is just a true story. And is that something that now has to be flagged for removal because it has an element of telling a story that is outside of the dominant narrative of Western expansion? Probably.
So Chakrin heads the Fund for People in Parks. It's an advocacy group that works with small or lesser known national parks in the West. And he says that the administration's definition of DEI is a complete misrepresentation anyways, and it's putting park leaders in an impossible situation.
So who is actually going to be removing books, and how soon could this happen?
So park leaders can start making changes to what's sold at their stores immediately. I spoke to a park superintendent who agreed to talk on the condition of anonymity for fear of losing their job. They told me that it's extremely frustrating to be in their position, essentially being told to ban books. So the superintendent went on to tell me they don't really want to remove anything, but they'll do their best to work with the staff at the park who typically review merchandise and then go from there. And the Interior Department, they said that they're trying to ensure that, quote, gift shops remain neutral spaces that serve all visitors, and that they're focused on minimizing any disruption to visitors during the review process.
Sarah Wright, KQED's outdoors reporter. Thank you.
Thank you.
Only 17% of Californians can afford to buy a typical single-family home, one of the least affordable states in the country. That's partly why housing advocates are calling for more state funding to support first-time home buyers, like one woman from Novato. KQED's Aaron Baldessari has her story.
Andy Rounds was living in an apartment in Novato back in 2016 when she got some bad news from her property manager.
They had just put us on a month-to-month basis, and I was mad.
Rounds works as a night nurse, and she has three kids, twins who were in middle school at the time, and a toddler.
I remember going down to the manager's office, and I was like, you guys can pretty much kick us out at any time, you know that. And they go, yeah, pretty much.
She started looking around for somewhere else to live when she saw a Facebook post that made her drop everything she was doing. Habitat for Humanity was accepting applications for a lottery to purchase a home at an affordable price. She was vying for just one of 10 spots. On the day of the lottery, once her kids were asleep, she logged in.
I go on there and I'm scrolling, I'm looking through, I'm like first, okay, second, third, and then I reach the 10th one. And it's my number.
She won.
I just burst out crying. I mean, going from a feeling of insecurity and instability to like, I'm going to be able to provide stability for my children. That feeling, every parent deserves to have that feeling.
As part of the program, she had to do more than 100 hours of training in financial literacy. No more than a third of her income goes toward her mortgage and monthly expenses. And she got to help build it, what Habitat calls sweat equity. Maureen Sidonian is CEO of Habitat Greater San Francisco.
It's not a giveaway. It's not like we're not Oprah. We don't be like, you get a house and you get a house.
To help subsidize the work, the organization relies on funding through CalHome. It's a state grant that supports a number of affordable ownership and home repair programs across the state. But it got zeroed out in the current state budget.
Homeownership programs are the very small minority of what's funded in affordable housing.
Her organization is now calling on lawmakers to add $500 million to CalHome in the coming fiscal year. Sidonian says if they do that, the organizations that rely on the program would be able to build or preserve around 5,000 more homes across California.
And this is not money that's going to go into a black hole. This is people's lives you're going to see that get transformed.
Andy Rounds has been in her home for about 8 years now. It's blue with two stories. There's a backyard where her son grows vegetables in the summer. She says having predictable monthly payments has allowed her to focus on her career and send her two daughters to college.
The pride in it, I just have no words, really.
Her home has also given her a place to recover and heal after she was diagnosed with breast cancer not long after moving in.
I don't know what I would have done But having my home, that was one of the big things for me. Every morning I would wake up, open my eyes, look up, and be grateful.
Grateful to have a place she knows she can afford, where the threat of being forced to leave is far behind her. I'm Erin Baldessari, KQED News.
And I'm Brian Watt. You're listening to Morning Edition on KQED.
Now, KQED traffic.
In Menlo Park, 101 southbound at Marsh Road, the second lane from the left blocked by a car, which is part of a crash with a pickup. Traffic slow back to Whipple Avenue. In San Jose, 880 northbound before the Alameda, the right lane blocked by a three-car crash. It is stacked up to the 280-17 merge. I'll have more details on the BART issues and delays in our next report. Mel Baker for KQED.
Thank you, Mel. Traffic transit support comes from Rush Creek Lodge and Spa Yosemite. Support for KQED comes from Netflix presenting The Perfect Neighbor, a documentary by Gita Gendebir. Body cam footage bears witness to a tight-knit community navigating one neighbor's relentless harassment and the consequences of Florida's Stand Your Ground laws. Awards eligible. You're listening to KQED NPR News. KQED News next.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The U.S. Supreme Court is considering today's oral arguments in a case that, as NPR's Andrea Hsu reports, could expand presidential power and erode that of some regulatory agencies.
This case started with the firing of Rebecca Slaughter. She was a Democratic commissioner on the Federal Trade Commission. That's the independent agency tasked with protecting consumers from unfair competition. And back in March, she got an email from the White House informing her that she was being removed from office, not because of any wrongdoing, but because her continued service was inconsistent with President Trump's priorities. She sued, saying the president can't fire her because federal law clearly states that FTC commissioners can only be removed for inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance in office.
Millions of people in the U.S. may see a sharp increase in their average health care premium at the end of the month. Congress has yet to decide if it'll extend Affordable Care Act subsidies. Health policy expert Gerard Anderson, professor at Johns Hopkins University, describes who stands to be affected.
Anyone who makes about $50,000 to $200,000 a year is going to have the greatest increases in their premiums, simply because the subsidies that were, additional subsidies that were put in, really benefited that population the greatest.
At last check on Wall Street, the Dow is down 124 points. This is NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. The number of workers on strike at the West Contra Costa Unified School District today will be less than late last week. That's because the district reached a tentative agreement with food service and clerical staff represented by the Teamsters over the weekend. But no deal has been reached with the teachers, who plan to be on strike again for higher pay and smaller classes today. District officials say they are reviewing a counterproposal from the United Teachers of Richmond, and talks could resume tomorrow. Medical experts at UC Berkeley say a lack of data on female bodies has left women athletes at a higher risk of injury. KQED's Aya Ali Ahmad reports a new initiative aims to help address that problem.
For decades, sports medicine has relied primarily on data from men, applying it to women for everything from concussion protocols to ACL recovery. Dr. Sydney Chang was the first female head team physician at UC Berkeley.
Less than 10% of sports medicine and sports science research has involved exclusively women athletes. Without that baseline epidemiological data, we have no idea how our interventions are going to impact injury rates and performance.
The new initiative will collect voluntary biometric data from Cal athletes to create predictive models for female physiology. Researchers say these tools will also help protect female firefighters and soldiers. I'm Aya Ali Ahmad, KQED News.
And I'm Brian Watt. There's more news at KQED.org.
Support comes from Oakland San Francisco Bay Airport. Beauty, pride, love. Learn more at iFlyOAK.com. Support for KQED comes from PG&E, reminding customers to act quickly if they smell gas in their homes or business. Get outside, travel a safe distance away, and dial 911. First responders will make it safe. Learn more at pge.com/safety.
Coming up next on the California Report, police in San Diego County aren't just using their own license plate cameras. They're also tapping into private cameras at malls, big box stores, even homeowner associations. I'm Adi Bolaños. A KPBS investigation found these networks are operating with very little oversight. Supporters say the system helps solve crimes. Critics worry it's a major privacy risk. That's ahead on the California Report.
Support for NPR comes from 20th Century Studios with Ella McKay, a new comedy from James L. Brooks, starring Emma Mackey, Jamie Lee Curtis, with Albert Brooks and Woody Harrelson. Ella McKay in theaters this Friday. And Capital One with the Capital One Quicksilver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And by the listeners, members, and sustaining members of KQED. Now 8:35.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Country star George Strait, disco legend Gloria Gaynor, and the rock band Kiss are now official Kennedy Center honorees. The 48th annual Kennedy Center Awards were given out Sunday night. President Trump didn't show up to these ceremonies in his first term. But as NPR's Andrew Limbong reports, this time he was the star.
Historically, presidents have taken a backseat at these things. Or more like box seat, they're up there with the honorees, with a wave here and there, clapping along, enjoying the show. But this year, President Trump became the first president to ever host the show. And when he was asked on the red carpet how he prepared for the gig, the president said,
"Well, maybe I haven't prepared. Maybe you want to be a little bit loose."
But the president has had a tight grip on the Kennedy Center since he began his second term. Back in February, he kicked out previous Kennedy Center president Deborah Rutter and installed himself as the chair of the board. Since then, he's had a close hand in choosing the honorees. He changed what the awards themselves look like from a rainbow ribbon to a more understated blue, and that's all on top of Trump's efforts to renovate the place, which was something the actor Kelsey Grammer, a supporter of the Kennedy Center and the president, praised on the red carpet last night.
I mean, I remember here the last time and I was like, looking pretty shaky. It was not a good thing.
So Grammer paid tribute last night to Michael Crawford, best known for his work in The Phantom of the Opera.
Open up your mind, let your fantasies unwind.
On the red carpet, Crawford said receiving a Kennedy Center honor was humbling, not something he thought he'd ever see.
At the end of a career, I didn't expect a phone call like that.
Speaking of the red carpet, it was a who's who of President Trump's supporters. Carrie Lake, Laura Ingraham, Stephen Miller, his wife and podcaster Katie Miller, who showed up in between the stars and honorees such as Gloria Gaynor, best known for her song I Will Survive. She was honored by the singer Ella King, gospel singers Debbie Winans, Chris Blue, and more. By the way, you aren't hearing any tape from the show itself because CBS is set to broadcast the proceedings later this month. But with the major exception of the president, the show itself was a fairly apolitical affair. Kurt Russell spoke about his friend and previous co-star Sylvester Stallone, who was greeted with orchestral renditions of Bill Conti's score from Rocky, conducted by Conti himself. And George Strait, the king of country, one of the highest-selling acts in the genre.
All my exes live in Texas.
Was honored by Vince Gill, Miranda Lambert, and more. And the show ended with a tribute to the rock band Kiss, who were short one member. Guitarist Ace Frehley died in October. Lead vocalist Paul Stanley said Frehley would have enjoyed being here.
It's still a celebration, and we can mourn him and celebrate what we've accomplished.
Yeah, I wish he was here. He's a very big part of the band.
Drummer Peter Criss.
I can't say enough about Ace. I miss him dearly. A very heavy subject right now. I don't want to break down and start crying about him.
The night ended with the band Cheap Trick doing a version of the Kiss hit I Wanna Rock and Roll All Night. But not all night. Things were wrapped up by 11. As for the future of the Kennedy Center honors, President Trump was asked who might be honored next year. He said it was a secret, but that a lot of people would like to be on his list. Andrew Limbaugh, NPR News.
Rescuing people after hurricanes, wildfires, and other major disasters is difficult and dangerous. There are 28 elite teams in the U.S. that do that work, and their expertise has never been in greater demand. NPR's Rebecca Hersher reports on the financial and political pressures they're facing.
So we have our cable.
Ryan Hogston is standing on top of a huge debris pile. A rusted car is perched on top of a culvert. Mangled rebar and steel beams poke out. Hogston points at a giant slab of broken concrete.
This piece right here, it needs to be tied back.
He's leading this training exercise for a group of five search and rescue experts from all over the country. They're pretending that there's a person trapped under the concrete slab, the way it could actually happen after a flash flood or a building collapse. It's not obvious how to secure the slab. The trainees start brainstorming.
My problem is, if we grab this...
If they attach a rope in the wrong place, the slab could shift and crush the imaginary survivor. They need to do a bunch of math to figure out how to proceed.
Quick calc says it's 24,000 pounds.
They compare the weight of the slab to the weights of things around it.
Just under 11,000.
21,000, I think, was my rough number.
After about 5 minutes, Hogston interrupts them. Time is ticking away, he points out.
So how can I get this done the fastest way?
The trainees decide to connect some chains in an X shape. Hogston gives them the thumbs up. The imaginary survivor is one step closer to being rescued. This training is one of more than a dozen that happen each year all over the country for the members of the 28 FEMA Urban Search and Rescue Task Forces. There are about 5,500 personnel in all. Most of them are local firefighters who do this in addition to their day jobs. Mike Mull is one of the founding members of Ohio Task Force 1 and was one of the people who responded to the World Trade Center site after 9/11.
They are supposed to be the elite. They are supposed to be the tip of the spear. And, you know, we have a little saying, it's like, it's up to us because we don't have anybody else to call. There is no 911 for us. We can't call another agency for help.
Last year, the country's urban search and rescue teams collectively responded to 9 major disasters, according to FEMA, which is the federal agency that oversees the teams. That's tied for the most in any year, going back to 1999. And climate change is making extreme weather disasters more and more common, which means this type of work is only getting more necessary. At the same time, there's enormous financial and political pressure on the country's search and rescue system, says Ken Begurek. He's the former head of FEMA's Urban Search and Rescue Branch.
Things are very in flux right now.
The Trump administration has proposed eliminating FEMA as it currently exists, leaving the future of the agency's search and rescue teams unclear. In June, Pagurek resigned from the agency because of concerns that the administration's policies are hurting its ability to respond to disasters. FEMA says it's maintained both funding and staffing for the search and rescue system since President Trump took office. But funding from Congress hasn't kept up with inflation, Pagurek says.
The system is underfunded. This is an ongoing issue for at least 15 years, maybe 20.
Some teams are struggling to pay for vehicle maintenance and other basics.
Let's bring it up and adjust it.
Back at the exercise in Ohio, trainees are using blow torches to cut through steel in confined spaces. Guys are cursing and sweating, claustrophobic as they practice.
Sure.
Instructor Ryan Hogston says a big part of the training is learning how to deal with the stress of searching for survivors for hours or days on end. In the dark, in the heat, in the rain, in the cold.
To be honest, we have to train ourselves to be calm. That's just what it is. You know, they pay us to be calm. That's our job.
Rebecca Hersher, NPR News, Dayton, Ohio.
This is NPR News.
There have been some BART system delays this morning, so let's go back to Mel for an update.
Yeah, this is due to trackway electrical problems in downtown San Francisco. Crews are on the way. There is, to ease traffic through the Transbay Tube, BART has canceled the red and green lines. The yellow line is still continuing on through the tube. The blue line has limited service between Dublin and Bayfair, where you'll have to transfer. All 50 stations are open. Be prepared for delays. Be prepared to transfer. Mel Baker for KQED.
Transit support on Monday comes from Shen Yun Performing Arts. I'm Dave Freeman with your KQED Monday Perspective at 8:43. Scarlett Morales explains why she struggled with her cultural identity.
Identity is supposed to be simple, right?
You're supposed to know who you are, where you come from, and belong. But for me, it's never felt that clear. I know I'm Mexican. My family is from Mexico. I grew up surrounded by the food, the music, the traditions. Spanish was always around me. And yet, I've never felt fully 100% Mexican. Yes, I speak Spanish, but not perfectly. My grammar slips, my vocabulary feels limited, and when I speak, I get self-conscious. It's like every mistake is proof that I don't measure up, and that hurts most with my grandparents. The past 3 summers, I've gone to Mexico to see them. They greet me with so much love and patience, but when it's time to talk, I freeze. I say quietly, letting my mom do the talking, even though deep down I want to connect. On phone calls, it's even harder. One of my grandparents is now terminally ill. Every call should be precious, but instead of showing up, I shrink away. I avoid the conversation, and afterward, I'm left with regret. The thing is, I do know my culture, but when I'm actually in Mexico, I feel like an outsider. And when I'm here in the U.S., I don't feel fully American either. So where does that leave me? For a long time, I thought it meant I was failing. Not Mexican enough, not American enough, not enough, period. But slowly, I've realized something important. Cultural identity isn't about being 100%. It isn't a test you can pass or fail. It's about layers. My identity is a mix. It's what makes me, me. So maybe I'll never feel fully Mexican in the way I once imagined, but I'm still Mexican in my own way. And more importantly, I'm learning to love that. I can accept myself, imperfect Spanish, mixed identity and all. Because this in-between space, it's still mine. With the perspective, I'm Scarlett Morales.
Scarlett Morales is a student living in Richmond. She enjoys listening to music and playing with her dogs. Support for Perspectives comes from Leif Cabraser, Hyman & Bernstein, seeking justice for the injured, victims of fraud, whistleblowers, employees, and investors in the Bay Area and nationally for over 5 decades. Online at lchb.com. Next on Morning Edition, it's been 1 year since Syria toppled longtime ruler Bashar al-Assad. How the nation is marking the anniversary today. That's ahead. Also, Mari Bolaños with California stories on your California Report from KQED News. Catch it at 8:51. Standing by, Alexis Madrigal kicks off Forum starting at 9, Forum 9 to 11 today. Support for NPR comes from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. The Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And by the sustaining members of KQED.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Amy Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Today, Syrians are marking the first anniversary of the fall of dictator Bashar al-Assad's regime. The opposition's leader, a former al-Qaeda fighter, is now Syria's president. He's been welcomed to the White House and embraced by many, although not all, Syrians. Correspondent Jane Araf is at the celebrations in Damascus and is on the line with me now. Hi, Jane.
Hi, Leila.
So where in the city are you? What are you seeing?
I'm in Amayat Square, which, as you know, is one of the big landmarks of the city. And
yeah.
You'll remember when we were in Damascus shortly after the fall of the regime. It was wild, right?
Yes.
There were people in the square all the time, waving flags, singing.
Yeah.
It's kind of like that now, only about 10 times more, thousands of people here. I mean, this is a brief lull in the celebrations, which really have been going on for the past few days. Fireworks, people driving around, honking their horns, it's been a holiday. But you can see the city now is a bit different, cleaner, more organized, and people here anyway are just full of joy. They're celebrating things that you can't feel, but they certainly do. It's that freedom from fear.
Yeah. And a year on, what else is happening to commemorate this day?
Well, as you know, after decades of the Assad leadership and then the civil war that lasted from 2011 to just last year,
yeah.
a lot of this joy is mixed with sorrow. Earlier this morning, we were at a mosque, one of the main mosques in the neighborhood, where the rebellion was particularly strong and hundreds of people were killed in the government crackdown. Their photos are now lining the walls of that mosque, and it went on for blocks. People in that mosque and across the country testified their faith, their Muslim faith, this morning at the exact time that Damascus was liberated. Those dawn prayers also gave thanks for the revolution. I spoke to one woman there. Some of them were going around pointing up photos of their missing or dead loved ones. And one woman told me she considered all of them her family. And that's because they're still finding mass graves here, that level of sorrow. Many people don't know what's happened to their loved ones.
Yeah. What about what the president of Syria, this new president, Ahmed al-Sharaa, which many Syrians believe in, but there are many Syrians who are skeptical of. What is he telling people on this day?
He's going to speak to the nation this evening in a major address, and he's been trying very hard to make this work, to make Syrians feel that this is their Syria.
Yeah.
But as you know, that has been set back somewhat by things that have happened, by massacres in some of the minority communities. And we spoke to one activist who says the challenge is to build institutions.
There should never be a country that is really all based on just one person's presence. And I think one of his challenges is to build the institutions and to build a political process that is representative, that allows Syria to survive if he, God forbid, dies any day.
Mawaz Mustafa from the Syria Emergency Task Force told us that essentially, you know, Sharaa himself, he says, is great, but what he needs is build institutions to bring people together.
That's Jane Araf in Damascus. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Time to check on your ride around the bay again with Mel, starting in Walnut Creek.
680 southbound before Treat Boulevard, two-car crash blocking the left lane. Strangely enough, traffic is nearly stopped back to the 242 merge and remains sluggish from there up to Concord Avenue on southbound 242. Benicia 780 westbound before Southampton Road East, an accident there blocking the right lane. Traffic is backed up to about 5th Street, and major delays on BART due to an electrical problem in downtown San Francisco. Mel Baker for KQED.
Transit traffic support on Monday comes from Gleim, the jeweler. Support for KQED comes from VisitorsCoverage.com, a marketplace for travel insurance, helping travelers find the right coverage for domestic or international trips, including cancellations, delays, and medical emergencies. Learn more at VisitorsCoverage.com. Support for KQED's car donation program comes from local Kia dealers announcing the Season of New Traditions event going on now at local Kia dealers, offering a selection of SUVs, sedans, and hybrids. More info at kia.com. Now 8:51.
Good morning. This is a California report. I'm Adi Bolaños in San Francisco. A long-running parade in Santa Barbara has been canceled this year after organizers raised concerns that immigrant families might stay home out of fear of potential ICE activity. Community groups say anxiety has been rising for months as federal immigration enforcement ramps up nationwide, and that even unconfirmed rumors of raids can keep families from public events. The parade, which usually draws thousands to the city's American Riviera waterfront, has been a major seasonal tradition for decades. Still, local leaders say they don't want to hold a celebration that could make parts of the community feel unsafe or force families to choose between holiday traditions and their own security. They're now working on smaller neighborhood events aimed at making people feel welcomed. More families needed help after federal food benefits were delayed last month. Jefferson Public Radio's Jane Vaughn checks in with North State Food Banks to learn how they're doing.
Food banks say those urgent requests for immediate need have slowed down a bit since benefits were distributed. But the holiday season is always a busy time when they serve extra families. Stacy Wadley is the director of Shasta County's food bank. She says many people calling have never needed food assistance before.
And a lot of them resisted coming in because they're like, well, that's not me, or I don't qualify. But you do qualify. You qualify right then. And take your turn. Give back later and take your turn now don't be afraid to come in and get help when you need it, because that's why food banks are there.
Wadley says they've also seen a gradual increase in need over the past couple years as food prices have increased. Food bank directors recommend people who want to help volunteer at local organizations or donate food or money. For the California Report, I'm Jane Vaughn.
Support for the California Report comes from Monterey Bay Aquarium, inspiring conservation of the ocean through amazing live exhibits and global action. More info at montereybayaquarium.org/connects. Stanford Medicine, comprising its School of Medicine and Adult and Children's Health Systems, working together to advance knowledge and improve lives. StanfordMedicine.org. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose philanthropy works to create a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org.
Dozens of cities and law enforcement agencies from around the state are using automated license plate readers. And in some cases, those communities are fighting back, suing to stop their use. KPBS investigative reporter Scott Rodd found that in San Diego County, law enforcement agencies are also searching license plate cameras owned by private businesses with little oversight.
Surveillance cameras in public spaces are nothing new. But the little black license plate readers mounted near each entrance of the Las Americas premium outlets are surveillance on steroids. They're made by Flock Safety, an Atlanta-based surveillance technology company, and they capture the license plate, make, and model of every car that enters the mall parking lot.
As soon as you come in, you know, it's in the system where they can run your information.
That's a former worker at the mall near the San Ysidro border crossing. He spoke with KPBS anonymously because he feared professional consequences for discussing company policies. At first, he embraced the Flock devices, believing they would help solve crimes. But he had second thoughts when he realized the power of these license plate readers. The mall gave several law enforcement agencies open access to search and receive notifications from the system.
If people knew more about it, I would say people will obviously be pissed off and very concerned.
Simon Property Group, which owns Las Americas, did not respond to multiple requests for comment. A months-long KPBS investigation found law enforcement agencies in San Diego County have access to dozens of these privately owned Flock surveillance networks, which include over 150 license plate cameras. Police can search and receive notifications from devices owned by Home Depot, Lowe's, Fashion Valley Mall, the Southwestern Yacht Club, and over a dozen homeowners associations. KPBS reviewed over 1,500 pages of police records to uncover them.
I think what people don't realize is how many of those cameras are linked together.
Rachel Levinson-Waldman is director of the Liberty and National Security Program at the Brennan Center for Justice in New York.
It can give rise to, I think, pretty significant inferences about what you're doing, who you're associating with. It can be used to create patterns of movement.
She says that's especially alarming given the recent controversies around Flock. The company has faced criticism after federal immigration authorities used local law enforcement to search license plate data around the country. And a growing number of cities are cutting ties with the company over privacy concerns. Flock spokesperson Holly Balin says the company has beefed up safeguards in response.
What Flock wants to make sure is that we offer all of the tools so that communities can decide for themselves what balance of safety they want to strike while protecting privacy, while adhering to the values of their communities.
KPBS spoke with several law enforcement agencies in San Diego County. They all touted the license plate readers. Commander Christopher Lawrence is with the San Diego County Sheriff's Office.
We've been able to solve multiple murders, several kidnappings, several rape cases, but the vast majority have been narcotic cases and stolen vehicle cases.
He says everyday San Diegans have nothing to worry about when it comes to privacy issues. KPBS went to Fashion Valley Mall to find out. The shopping center gives police access to its license plate readers. We spoke to several shoppers. None of them knew about the mall's Flock system, but they all wanted to learn more. 55-year-old Gilberto Corneman believes the arrangement improves public safety.
I appreciate what they're doing, and it's good for the city, the state.
others expressed concerns. 29-year-old Alexa Sandoval used to work at the mall and saw shoplifting firsthand. She understood the upside of giving police access to the system. But now, as a consumer, she's not so sure.
If we're not really doing anything wrong here, do they really need to have all of our information?
46-year-old Phil Rivas expressed serious reservations about the camera-sharing arrangement.
Here in the United States, we want privacy as much as possible and transparency. It seems like companies or corporations are going out of their way to just, you know, not give us that privacy.
Rivas says he supports helping law enforcement solve crimes, but he thinks customers should know about the technology being used. For the California Report, I'm Scott Rodd.
This story was co-reported by KPBS investigative reporter Gustavo Solis. And that's the California Report for Monday, December 8th. We're a production of KQED News. I'm Adi Bolaños. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Forum in a minute. Let's go back to Mel with a BART update.
Just getting the latest details worked out here. So BART is still running system-wide as they recover from an earlier electrical problem on the trackway in downtown San Francisco. BART is now telling us that all lines are being restored. The red and green line, you recall, had been delayed, had been taken out of service temporarily. But be prepared for delays throughout the system. Mel Baker for KQED.
Transit and traffic support comes to us from Murphy McKenna Construction Custom Home Builders. Support for KQED comes from Devils in Details, a Duke Magazine podcast. Listeners can explore Made for This, Blue Chair Conversations featuring candid interviews with Duke changemakers and what inspires them, available across podcast platforms. I'm Dave Freeman. Good morning.